Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas by The Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to important issues facing our society today. Today's guest is Chanel Rion. Chanel is the former chief White House correspondent for One America News Network. She now hosts her own show on OAN called Fine Point with Chanel Rion. She entered journalism after earning her degree in international relations from Harvard, and since then has been at the center of exposing some of the most impactful stories in recent politics, and has special insight into the transformation of America's media that we're witnessing, as well as access to the news that's emanating from the White House itself. Chanel and I have a great conversation about her experience and perspective on where we are with America's news and journalism, on censorship, and on her views on how to restore the media's most crucial role, holding the powerful accountable. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Hey, Chanel, welcome. Thank you for being here.
What an honor to join you. Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate it. I know you're very busy and you're a pro, so you're going to help this podcast by just your professionalism, I'm sure. And by the way, I just want to say, this is a sort of a recently formed podcast that I started, but I am very concerned with, of all the institutions, the media, journalism. And so people that listen to this podcast, they may notice that I've been really talking to a lot of journalists and media because really, in my view, you know, media is the ultimate citizens check on power.
Yes.
And without performing that role, at least on a day-to-day basis, you know, we don't have voting every 5 minutes. So the media coverage is so crucial. And I think there is not only importance to it, but there's a huge ethical burden of responsibility to being honest, to inform the citizens. And I'm quite concerned that we've lost that. And so first, you're really here because you are sort of unique in a couple of ways. Number one, you're an important voice in challenging the legacy media dominance of journalism, both with your independent show on OAN, but also simply having worked at an alternative network, really. So I think that's very critical. And secondly, as everyone knows, you were the chief White House correspondent during Trump version one for OAN. And this is how we actually met, because when I was in those press briefings, and this is sort of the first topic I want to talk about, and I'm in the room and I look back and I see you standing at the back, as opposed to sitting down in the chairs. And so I would like to sort of go back to that because, of course, that's a very important part of some of the transformation of media and news flow now that we're going to see and we are seeing from the White House. So tell the viewers and the listeners, why were you standing at the back?
Well, it might be important to remember the context. Remember under that liminal space that we existed in, where we didn't know what this virus was. We didn't know to what extent it could, you know, maim, kill, or destroy us. There were so many questions about COVID-19. And so everyone reacted with a fair bit of trepidation and caution, which included imposing distance measures inside that briefing room. So when you say standing in the back, it's not like what you're seeing in the day-to-day pressers you're seeing now, where there's dozens of people standing. I was standing alone in the back because everyone else had seats. Everyone was separated, three seats from each other, very sparse. And that was really kind of the accidental opening of a chapter to a fight I didn't pick. And what I mean by that is, for the longest time, the White House press briefing room was controlled by a monopolistic cabal called the White House Correspondents Association. And they ran the White House like they owned the place. They were giving the White House press office orders about who could sit where in the briefing room, who could access the president, who could be placed on pools, that is, traveling with the executive and, you know, meeting with the, you know, the top leaders of the world when they came to visit. WHCA, one nonprofit organization, decided all of this. And so the reason it was kind of different that I was standing in the back was I was not a member of the WHCA. The WHCA tried to remove me from the press briefing room because they did not like that I was bringing in a conservative journalistic perspective. And when they tried to eject me, I simply said, I shrugged and I said, well, what authority do you have to kick me out? And they always had an answer. You know, we run the place. This is how it's done. This is how it's done. The White House intervened when I raised this to them and graciously invited me to stand in the back of the briefing room every day during the COVID briefings. And that's how it came to be, that I was the person standing in the back. I was roped off. They taped off a little section for me. At some point, I brought in a little wooden chair, brought in my own seat, and there opened up a very, very interesting chapter, a symbolic stand against establishment media as it was captured by the WCA. Inside that briefing room, they filtered who got to ask what questions, and therefore that monopolistic cabal filtered out the president's message, and that was just wrong. Right. We stood up to that.
Right. Excellent. And that's, of course, very important to do, because it's even inside the media, I think there is this incredible control of information. And that is one way it was done. And now what I see, and I think what we're all seeing, is this era of a complete transformation of information access and what I will call the media. And I want to first talk about from the White House itself, because now we see, and I think you're the initiator or origin of this whole concept, that who should be even involved in the interviewing the president in the press briefings. And now we have a president, of course, who has press briefings essentially every day inside the Oval Office, and they have opened it up to not only non-legacy network and outlet sources, but they've also opened it up to pure internet, pure Twitter type, or, you know, a Facebook or other, you know, access. I think this is really not only emblematic of the change, but critical to make that change.
It is critical because, you know, the people that they that this White House is allowing to participate in the process, I know a lot of them are known personalities online. And when I say personalities, I don't mean that in a derogatory manner. I simply mean they have a certain set of listeners. And we now exist in a world no longer where there's just a set number of channels that the whole world has access to. We don't live in a world where there's just three newspapers that everyone reads. We live in a world where everyone picks and chooses their news curators. We have become news curators, information curators. And so it is important that the White House is recognizing that there are categories of people who fill a void of information gathering that is not necessarily filled by the top six networks that monopolize the news space now.
Absolutely. But I don't want to give the impression that mission accomplished. I mean, not yet. This is just sort of in that old way to say it. It's not the beginning. It's not the end. It's not the beginning of the end. It's not even the end of the beginning. We're sort of in the middle of the beginning, maybe, because I, as you know more than I, you know, when the New York Times writes something, no matter how much those of us who dislike the editorialized news of outlets, including particularly New York Times and Washington Post, et cetera, you know, they still have massive impact. And I don't mean just massive impact in the United States. They have massive impact all over the world. And it's still the case, is it not?
It absolutely is.
The New York Times or the AP is picked up all over the world, and it is rewritten under the byline of any number of local news and national news sources inside the U.S., but also outside the U.S. That is still true. Correct?
You're absolutely right. It is still true. I recently gave us a talk at one of your events and shared, you know, that it's 90% of all media are really in the hands of about 200 executives in the United States. 200. And when you break down and you think about who, and you look at the names of these people who run 90% of our media, they're not exactly liberty-minded individuals. So that should be very concerning. It's not that we want to eliminate the left. We just need to make sure that there's enough room for other viewpoints. And by and large, the media industrial complex is dominated by individuals who are very adverse to liberty, very adverse to this idea of individual freedoms, because they bought into this whole system of going through the academic class, which isn't wrong, but the academic class, as you well know, is very compromised right now. They buy into this whole idea that you know, the sovereign individual is a bad thing, that communal organization is where the world needs to be. And so that's when they blur the line between information gathering, fact gathering, truth seeking, and they blur it so that they are now advocating, they are now pushing a certain agenda. And again, to each his own. If everyone wants to push their own agenda, do that. But the problem now is that you have all this condensation of power, even with the rise of new media, because yes, the fight has not yet begun the fight. So all of these news entities are now figuring out, look, the only way we survive is to compartmentalize ourselves and attach ourselves to the government. And they have. They have through organizations like NewsGuard. I was just interviewing the great Mike Benz, who does a lot of work on censorship online and news gathering and news dispersion. And he's been tracking NewsGuard for years. What is NewsGuard? It's an organization. They claim to be a for-profit organization that simply tries to track down misinformation. And they provide a ranking service for news outlets. Mm-hmm. And they claim to provide this service that is very benevolent. It's all about improving society's access to information and facts. Mm-hmm. And they're doing the opposite. They're ranking places like New York Times as having a 100% trustworthiness rating, and places like OAN, New York Post, Epoch Times as having a below 20 rating. Why? Because we say that the COVID virus was potentially man-made. Because we say that, we get a 20 rating. Now, the problem
this whole thing, I'm sorry to interrupt, but there's something that is sort of really makes me crazy that you alluded to, which is this whole word misinformation. Okay. Mm-hmm. We have, and I really hate to use the word, and I'm sure you hate to use the word too, because that, you know, this is a sort of an Orwellian placement of vocabulary creation, really, to vilify, demonize, marginalize, delegitimize other views. Or other information. And it's instead of just saying it's false, there's this sort of misinformation and disinformation concept, which I think, you know, there's so many issues to talk about with this. But first of all, there is no one who should be trusted to label something, let alone claim something is misinformation or disinformation. I mean, haven't we learned that? We didn't even need to learn that, but I guess apparently a lot of people think that that's true, that somehow hearing something that's a dissenting view or opinion is dangerous. And I think that's terrible. The only solution to this so-called misinformation is more information. That's obvious to me in a free society, and it's frightening that that is not deemed obvious by everybody. But before we go into the censorship thing, I want to go back to something more fundamental, which is it's not just about, to me anyway, it's not just about allowing a different opinion, a different view. It's literally not allowing or not having a place for objective information, because there is something called objectivity. There really is. The problem it's very difficult to find. And here, I'm not saying at all that people aren't entitled to have their opinion or even broadcast it, but it's opinion. And I think what we've seen, and again, this is again, possibly that I'm just naive, but I remember an era when it certainly seemed like the news was objective. It wasn't always editorialized. And now I think that's very difficult to find. What do you see in the news reporting world these days? Not the opinion side, but actually the news reporting. Are we finished with objective reporting and no one wants to even hear it? Or is there a thirst for it, and what is being done for it?
I think this has to do with a lot of similar conversations we've had about culture. We are currently in a space where we're in this wild west of opinions. And if you go to X, there's any number of people that you could follow who all have their various hot takes. And that's the market right now. The market is who has the hottest takes and who has the spiciest phrases to throw out there on any given news topic. And so the shift has been more towards opinion instead of news and facts. And as pendulum swings go, when you oversaturate the market with all of these opinions, eventually there becomes this thirst or hunger for a slightly more objective, a slightly calmer take, a calmer collection of facts. And I think my hope is that there is going to be kind of a pendulum swing more towards that. I think if you do want to set yourself apart today in the X space, in the MAGA influencers world, in the news influencers world, if you do want to set yourself apart, you move more towards that. I don't know if some of you may recognize, but remember the Charlie Rose kind of tone of just kind of sitting there and you're being inquisitive. You're not totally throwing a viewpoint out there, but you are, you know, pushing and prodding and asking. I think there's going to be a hunger for that after all the saturation of opinion journalism. I'm not saying that's what's happening now. But yes, that's my prediction. I think that because that's where we are, because we have so much new media now. You look at the briefing room now. It's not just, you know, me standing alone in the back and I was the only conservative voice in the room. It's now, you know, 100 people are stuffed in that room. It's a complete saturation of new media now. So that, I think that's the hope potentially to your question.
I like your analogy, because I think we're seeing this pendulum idea in pretty much everything, which is that it swung too far in one direction in everything we see. And I think, it has to come back, and perhaps it's going to swing a little bit too far toward opinion. I don't know. I'm happy to hear the opinions. I'm not at all opposed to all this opinionized reporting, because it's certainly more interesting. But on the other hand, it's nice, and I even get asked, and maybe you do too, where do I go for objective news? Because I think there is a recognition that we sort of, it's good to gather your own information, but, you know, people don't have time to drill down on every detailed source.
Right.
And so, you know, we'll see what happens with this. But I think it's definitely the best trend is more information. And I think that was the original promise of the internet.
Right.
And then, to my horror, it seemed to become a tool for censorship. Once everyone was on social media, or many people, then it became a way to manipulate people and censor out things you don't want, which brings me to my second topic, really, which is censorship. And, you know, this, again, I think a lot of things were really exposed by the pandemic and the pandemic malfeasance, I'll call it, the mismanagement, because we were aware of these institutional failures, including the editorialization of news for years. But it really hit home when we were all personally affected by these things and really horrified at what happened to people during the pandemic management, with distortion of fact, with censorship, et cetera. And now we have something that people, even people like me who are just laymen with regard to the media are calling this sort of censorship industrial complex, and the sort of a collusion, a web of common interest, but from different takes. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is, let's just say the Twitter files that were exposed as an example, where we see the Biden administration aggressively trying to persuade, at the minimum, social media companies to censor things, which I think is incredible to me. I thought we lived in a free country, and that by definition is not. But no. I do want to point out that this has been sort of distorting what really happened during the pandemic, because what really happened is the social media companies themselves, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, took it upon themselves to censor people, including myself as advisor to the president during an emergency, but worse, even the president of the United States. And this was shocking to me. Was this shocking to you as somebody who's been in journalism that actually predated the pandemic?
It was only shocking that we were able to reveal it and confirm it, because operating on the social media space as a conservative news gatherer, as someone who gathered news and facts through the lens of being an anti-monopolist, anti-big everything, you only just had a gut sense. Hard to explain it, but you just had a gut sense that something was off, that material that normally would be promoted or pushed out was being suppressed. And you would just sound like a crazy person if you went out there and said, oh, X is censoring me, Facebook is censoring me. And it was also a cop-out for people who really didn't have great content, and they were trying to say, well, I really should be more popular than I am. And when a lot of this was exposed under the Twitter files through Jim Jordan's Judiciary Committee investigation exposing a lot of this, it was just gratifying to know that the clues and indications and the circumstantial kind of senses that we got that conservative perspectives were being censored was confirmed in the open. So to answer your question, no, I wasn't shocked. I was shocked to the extent that they were just being blatant about it. The White House would communicate with X, literally flagging jokes and memes. And it was stunning to see that
2021, 2022 White House, yes.
Yes, under Biden. And it was stunning to see that very smart people inside the Biden administration knew that they were sending a written record to someone else saying, hey, I want you to censor this American, censor this journalist, censor Tom Fitton, censor Chanel Rion, censor these people, and didn't think that somehow all of that would come to light in the future. So what was shocking about it was the, I guess, the lack of humility, I think, that they had.
The arrogance that they could do that.
Yes, the arrogance of believing that you could do that, you could get away with it, and somehow you were still in the right. Because you would mm-hmm. follow a lot of these names. I'd looked them up. You'd follow a lot of these names later on, and they're still pushing about the moral need to suppress information. And it's a vital role for all humanity for us to basically get rid of the First Amendment. And
well, I think this is very important, very important point here that people need to understand. This is not over at all.
Far
and
from
in
it.
Fact, last week I was at a panel at a university in the Midwest on the topic of censorship at universities and online and in the media. This was the topic of the event. I was a speaker along with a couple of other people. And one of the other panelists was associated with Stanford University's Stanford Internet Observatory Project, which is a computer science-based project to monitor and literally censor media and the social media world. And this topic that we went into on that panel was the topic was the role of artificial intelligence and what is this frightening AI? Is this what's happening. And we're at the very early stages of AI, everyone knows. And, you know, I think it's a very powerful, potentially positive tool in many, many ways, of course. But the shocking part to me on the panel was that this person talked about how she was very excited about the use and development of AI technology to, quote, improve censorship, to do a better job of censoring. And to me, this is the most frightening part of AI, really. I think it's to distort truth is a problem because you can make things look like they actually happened, whether it's interviews or news reports or whatever with AI. But even worse, we have a tool here that, again, it depends. We need ethical people in these fields because we have a tool here that will absolutely be used to do more nuanced, more sophisticated censorship. This is a country, I don't have to tell you this, and I don't have to tell anybody who listens really, but I can't get it out of my head that in the United States, founded on freedom, with the Declaration of Independence specifically, explicitly saying that these are freedoms that were endowed by God, yet we have people not only intending to censor, not only trying to justify it, not only valuing it, but I fear that we actually have a large population of people in the United States who think it's good to censor other people.
The 60 Minutes expose or investigation in Germany that was released recently is such a beautiful sample of that mindset that thinks, that genuinely thinks that censoring thought is a good idea. And these are people who don't study history or they're willfully ignoring it. These are people who don't read Orwell. These are people who have God complexes, to put it simply. They have a God complex. They believe that big government is God and benevolent. And that in that benevolence, they truly seem to believe they're doing the right thing by attempting to control, with a capital C, control us. And so I think the scariest thing about AI, and you hit on this, but the scariest thing about AI to me, and I love it, I think it's an incredible tool that will just absolutely expand humanity in a way that the airplane did, the light bulb or electricity. I truly believe that. But the scariest thing about it is all the wrong people are getting excited about it and controlling it. Mm-hmm. Exactly the wrong. All the people who love liberty that I talk to, when I talk about AI with them, for the most part, with the exception of you, they go, oh, it's so scary. It's so terrifying. It's terrible. It is terrible. But we need to, as you say, make sure that the right people are throwing themselves wholeheartedly into understanding how to control it, how to utilize it. And in doing so, we're going to be able to combat how the left is using it. Right now, my big concern is in the AI civil liberties space. I'm currently in my second year of law school, and that's really the focus that I want to take my degree into. I believe that the Constitution and AI are in a collision course, and we don't have enough big thinkers thinking about AI from the perspective of liberty and protecting our core Bill of Rights. Everybody who's doing AI policy right now is in the EU for the most part. And so when suddenly Congress wakes up and says, oh my goodness, we have to figure out how to deal with this massive problem AI is posing to the First Amendment, Second Amendment, whatever it may be, their staffers are just going to be referring to policies that have been drafted up at the EU, and the EU does not have a Bill of Rights. Their mentality, the government is here to protect, the government is the benevolent force. And
even worse, actually, in the UK, which is, of course, sort of separate from Europe, but
egregious,
not really, but they're really extreme, at least for now, in criminalizing people's social media tweets and really sort of, quote, cracking down on freedom of thought and freedom of speech. Because if you crack down on freedom of speech, you have interfered with freedom of thought, obviously. I mean, this is very, very frightening. And you're right. When Silicon Valley, which is sort of, at least from my point of view, and I work at Stanford, so I have a perspective that is distorted by being out here. But when Silicon Valley is the dominant player in AI, that's frightening, because most of Silicon Valley believes in censorship. And I don't say that sort of generalization lightly, but it's sort of obvious to me, and it has, I'm not at all a believer in sincerity of tech moguls who come in all of a sudden, Trump's popular, therefore, right. Oh yes, I'm yeah. pro-Trump. No, that's now, just
it's a
not,
portrait of yeah. survival. It's a very yeah, nasty
it's
portrait
survival
of survival.
And also
them.
Just, you know, that they want to be on the winning side. I have a very low view of many of these people. That's a separate topic. But you know, I did see, I have to say that to reassure people, excuse me, that I was speaking in London at this Jordan Peterson's ARC conference recently, and they had a discussion with Peter Thiel, who is a libertarianish type, in my view, if I could summarize him as that. And he's central to a lot of these new emerging technologies. And he was very adamant that we need to be not afraid of AI, but they're developing it and expanding it so that we don't have premature regulation of it, which I totally agree with him yes. on that. But to have
he's
people
right
like
that.
Him, and of course, Elon Musk, who, you know, to me, I'm going to say something that maybe people don't agree with, which never bothers me, obviously. But Elon Musk, to me, is the most important person in my lifetime for freedom of speech, because of him buying and opening what is really the town hall of people in the United States and maybe in the world, which is Twitter. And I don't know how you feel about that, but I think, yes, there's momentum on social media because he intervened here. I think it was a complete nightmare what was going on. My Twitter as advisor to the president was taken down and during the emergency.
That's
you'd
right.
You'd think in a free society, people would want to hear what the advisor to the president was advising. But no, you know, Facebook was bragging about having taken down millions of posts in 2020.
And they were dead wrong.
They were dead wrong. So it was censorship and also denial of fact to manipulate the public. I mean, this is, I think, more than Orwellian doesn't do justice to what was done. So it's very frightening. And AI, you know, it's very premature. Nobody in government, by the way, knows a thing about AI.
No.
These people are... Mm-hmm. I'll be nice and say they're naive and unknowledgeable. That's a polite way of saying they're completely inept and way out of their league. And this is true with most things, frankly. I saw it with my own eyes. But I'm very concerned with when I hear people saying that AI is a great tool for refining censorship. And then I see people who I personally know on Facebook's advisory board on saying, well, no, we need to get better at censorship. We need to have more voices involved in saying, is something misinformation? No, that's completely antithetical to the core freedom that we have in the United States. And if I personally believe in very, very limited restraints on free speech, I know, and you're in law school, and you know the analogy, oh, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Okay. And you can't defame people in theory, although that was very prevalent and still is in the media. But I would much rather err on the side of freedom of speech. We're adults. Yes. You know, we're thinking people. We're not blind animals. I think we need to stop underestimating and stop being this protector of people's hearing things that they don't agree with. Moreover, as I continue this sort of mini rant, on the university campus, we can't teach critical thinking to young people if they don't hear different views. This is obvious by definition. And, you know, so I would like to hear your thoughts on this and also have you give your sort of law student, but also more sophisticated view on this idea of New York Times versus Sullivan.
Yes. Yeah, 1967. New York Times v. Sullivan, there's a lot of talk that we need to revisit New York Times v. Sullivan. And obviously, you know, it's a hallmark case that really, you know, the freedom of the press and any discussion about, you know, going after public figures was defined by this case. And there's been so much debate about it. You know, I think there are portions of it that need to be revisited, but all in all, you hit something beautifully there, and that is we're all adults. The problem is people who believe in a big nanny government need complacent minds in order for them to carry out their plan. So for you, Dr. Atlas, to stand up and say, everyone's a critical thinker and we all are adults here, is a very damaging idea to them, because it means that there's going to be resistance for their plan to be carried out. And critical thinkers are dangerous. They're dangerous to the globalist plan. They're dangerous to anyone who wants to exert more control, because if you are on the side that believes that more control by a centralized force is good, you need the least amount of resistance you can find. And how do you do that? You raise a generation that is addicted to all manners of flippant, irrelevant topics, things, apps, games, whatever it is. Get them addicted to things. And then get them addicted to, you know, crazed ideas about the world. Get them all messed up in the head. That's the best way to control people. You don't want people who are informed. If you're a globalist, you don't want people who are historically informed. You don't want people who are critical thinkers and are going to question the direction they're taking you. You know, one of the blessings and the curses of being a conservative is that we are so independent, generally, critical thinkers generally, that we're not very good at playing in the team. And that is why we lose so much on the institutional game, because liberal-minded people, people who are more about centralizing power and control, they are much more amenable to control and movement and getting in a team and working together. And so that is playing in their favor. But any day ever, ask me what side I'd rather be on. I'd rather be on the more fractured, independent-minded, critical thinking side. I would rather stand in the minority any day than stand in the blob that is the mindless majority. And I fear, you brought this up earlier, we cannot fall into that complacent game of saying we won and then going off on a reveled party that lasts for the next 4 years. The fight has only just begun, and we have to keep thinking that, or else we are going to lose every single fight that comes our way because we're drunk on this power of having won, quote unquote. We haven't won. All these people, all these forces we've been fighting have just reshuffled. They're reshuffled. That's right. They're relabeling themselves, and they're just hiding. They're waiting for us to go get complacent. I brought up NewsGuard earlier. If you look at the board members who sit on NewsGuard, these are all former CIA people. These are all people who have radically globalist agendas. And I can assure you, if you went through that list and you saw who was on the board of NewsGuard censoring other news outlets, you would agree those people did not overnight transform into these America first, freedom loving, Trump supportive minds. They are still very much of the mindset that a $300 pair of AI glasses that censors your biases is a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very frightening sort of concept. And you don't want to be extremist and say the worst case scenario will happen, but you have to be, you can't fool yourself, because as a famous scientist, Richard Feynman, said, the problem with looking at your own data, in his case, science, a physicist, is that you can't fool yourself. And the problem is you're the easiest person to fool.
I like that.
With your own opinions. So this is sort of a tricky world we're in. And, I wonder, we're watching, as I mentioned, the transformation of media. I feel this is really a different phase here that we're in, where social media came out. We didn't know what to make of it. Everybody thought X, Y, Z, and then it was sort of transformed differently. But now things are accelerating rapidly with this alternative media, et cetera, the individual person, interacting with anybody in the world, whoever they want, et cetera. And I wonder if you could use your sort of experience to project, where is this headed? I mean, do you think that there will never be any more news services? Will there be no more newspapers? Will TV be obsolete as a way to even get news? I mean, is everything going to online? And I'm talking, when I say project, I'm talking, what are we going to see over the next 5 years? What is the trend here? Where are we headed?
I think the people who control media, they're pretty smart people. They didn't get to the top 200 of, 90% of the world's media, of America's media, because they were dumb. They're pretty smart. So they know how to survive for the most part. I think they survive by compromising new media. And they'll buy them out, they'll bring them in, they'll write these big checks, and little by little, they'll try to erode the power. But the issue is there's just so much. There's so the volume of new media. And
it'll be harder to control. I think you're right. So. A lot of the new media will be just like the old media. Mm-hmm. I think it would be a big challenge to say that they can monopolize it.
More difficult for them to monopolize. So I don't know what their game plan is. I think that they will reconfigure. They will figure out how to survive. They're like cockroaches, throw a nuclear bomb and they'll still be around. But will they be as powerful as they once were? I don't believe they will. I think they will remain powerful if they take their disinformation, misinformation, censoring projects, these pet projects that thrived under the Biden White House. They've moved all of those to London. The UK is their playground for experimenting with how to manipulate public access to information. So they're going to, I think, reconfigure themselves in Europe and the UK and just wait this season out. And they'll swoop back in. And I think that's we just have to remain vigilant. We have to protect this kind of decentralizing body of news gathering and this decentralized body of fact gatherers and news generators. We need to protect them by simply ensuring that we don't allow monopolies to continue to dictate who is popular, who gets the platform, who gets access to the public spaces. And so,
including social media monopolies.
100%. And even Elon Musk, I mean, he is a hero in my book, but even he is prone to the traps that come with having too much power. So we just have to remain ever vigilant, and the future of new media looks very bright. I'm so encouraged by the fact that there's so much dilution out there. And so, like I said earlier in the segment, I'm looking forward to a new trend where substance will reign. Not flashy this or flashy that, but substance.
Right.
I suspect there is a return for that, because look at what happened with the Epstein files recently. Prime example of how kind of influencers all swooped down on the White House. They all walked out triumphantly with a binder of Epstein files. And it turns out it was a big flop because, the information they held were things that we've largely known. There was nothing new there, and people really reacted, to my surprise, very negatively, even to these names that are very popular inside these circles. I mean, the public backlash to the flop that that was and the non-substance that that was incredible. And I saw that as something that was a hopeful sign. We're moving in a direction where the news audience, the new media news audience, is going to be far more critical and will have a higher standard of wanting to see facts and evidence, like hard evidence. We don't want to see more of this, forecasting exciting headlines or this is going to be big, this is going to be big clickbait. I think there's going to be exhaustion over that. And you saw that with the release of the Epstein files recently. There's exhaustion and people are now just looking for receipts, documentation, facts. And I think that's a very good direction for new media.
I hope you're right. And that isn't just a one-off. I still, when you go on Twitter, as an example, I personally think most of the social media posts are almost irrational, not worth reading, insane. It's a way to have people sort of shout out at everybody, including people that they would never normally be able to interact with. But I do think it's a huge net positive. There's no doubt in my mind about that, to have the, like you say, the decentralization process itself of information. The question really is, how do we sort of restore trust in the information purveyors? We can't, I feel like it's sort of an example of the pendulum idea, where if you get, let's just say it's completely decentralized and everybody is a journalist all of a sudden, at some point people don't want to have, they don't have time for that. And it's just like everything else. I mean, we can't swing the pendulum to, all experts, since experts failed, therefore all expertise is irrelevant and nothing exists, and I think the same thing goes with journalism. It's not just health science or anything else or policy. And so I'm wondering how to restore trust. One thing that I am personally committed to is getting smart young people who have an ethical compass to go into journalism. Okay. I mean, it's not traditionally been, it's not as highly lucrative, although I think everything's changing now. But I mean, when I was a little kid, from my socioeconomic background, anybody who was smart, you should be a doctor. And if you can't do that, well, then you have to be a lawyer. This is what I was literally told, sort of joke, but it's true that that's what I was told. But, we need great people to see the importance of journalism. And I think we are getting there's some great young journalists out there who are really investigative journalists, reporters in the traditional sense. We need to get that going, but we need more. I'd like to hear your thoughts on how do we restore trust, including this sort of industry of so-called fact checkers that are just completely harmful to the public good.
I think recently there was a CNN fact check on the president's joint address to Congress, and people were making fun of it, rightfully so, because CNN fact checked something that Trump had said. And then when people pointed out that they were wrong, CNN had to fact check their fact check.
Right.
So episodes like that, someone was mocking it. That's a very good thing. And his mockery of it got millions of views. That's a good sign. That's how you take them down. You take them down, you mock them, you show their hypocrisy. And oftentimes humor is a phenomenal way to do it, but investigative journalism is a wonderful way to do it. I think for cultivating our younger people and talented, ethical minds to go into media, I think we're going to have to put a pause on pulling people from the journalism schools, because the journalism schools have, for the most part, become indoctrination camps, and it's just too far gone. We need to completely revamp whatever it is they call journalism school, and really pull.
Is there more of a political bent to the journalism schools than the general university campus?
There absolutely I'm asking is. This.
I don't know.
I think there absolutely is. While most academia is infiltrated by largely leftward leaning individuals, like 95% of people who are involved in academia tend to lean left, with journalism, it's especially the case because it generally attracts people who are not really monetarily motivated. So these are not capitalists. And then second of all, so you've already got a bad filter there. Not saying that you have to be drawn to money, but
one
of the filters is like if you're someone who believes merit and good work should be rewarded, you tend to like money. And if you find people who don't like any of that, you're going to be pulling from automatically a pretty self-selected group. So that's number one. Number two, you know, these are all like retired Marxist hippies who grew up on Woodward and Bernstein, and they got a taste of
the
what
professors.
It is like. Yes. And those professors got a taste of what it is like. You know, one story can change the world. And they are speaking to a group of people who have all these grand designs about fame. And they believe, well, I couldn't make it in Hollywood, so let me make it in the news world. And not saying obviously everyone's like that, but I think those are factors that play into what is damaging journalism schools today. I never went to journalism school. I studied international relations. I was going into policy. I was going into law. And I fell into the media world. And what I discovered journalism used to be an apprenticed job. It used to be something that if you knew how to write, if you could write competently and you could tell a story well and you could talk to people and pull information, then you were a journalist. We don't have that. We don't have an apparatus right now that allows us to spot talent, starting with writing ability. I think first and foremost, we have to have people who can write. And I'm stunned by the amount of incompetence I see in the writing field. People mm-hmm. cannot write. I did in my monologue, my show, I talked about the plague of illiteracy. And when you look at the numbers, I mean, United States, we're just above Zimbabwe in our basic literacy levels. And that's stunning.
Incredible,
that's really shameful. But then you get to the reading levels and 70% of Americans don't have an eighth grade reading level. So when you can't read, you also cannot write. And when you cannot write, you cannot sit down and think and put thoughts together. Even kids that I went to school with at Harvard, they had to go through remedial writing programs and really had to hone in their writing. You had to learn to write well by the time you graduated. And the kids who arrived at school from high school, all these accolades, rave reviews from their professor, their high school teachers, they would arrive having no ability to actually write and analyze and make an argument.
I sort of fear that the dominance that we see happening in social media, there is a downside here. There are many, but one of them actually is that the attention span of people reading is very short.
Yep.
You know, we all know the number of characters on Twitter for a tweet and, you know, the videos that you put out, people don't watch. All the people that click on a 30-minute video, they actually, very few go for more than 5 minutes.
Right.
You know, I think that's a serious issue that I don't know how to address. But the other issue that we talked about offline was the sort of decline of book reading and this idea that books, you know, you sound like some kind of old man from a different era. But, you know, I was a little kid. I used to go to the bookmobile in my neighborhood. They used to come around and I would take out 10 books, 12 books at a time. And people, you know, books are becoming a lost art. I mean, are we all going to be just looking at some kind of synopsis online? And then, you know, I just wonder about that. And I think I agree with you. You cannot write. And I feel unless you read a lot, that's how you learn how to write. And, you know, I wonder where we're headed with that.
I don't think the future looks very bright on that part. I wish I could say there's going to be a pendulum on that, too. But I fear that you're right. We're so conditioned now. Even those of us who didn't grow up with smartphones, we're so conditioned now for short snippets that inevitably, I think that's the direction we are headed in terms of content. That doesn't mean that people who do take the time to actually engage long form aren't going to stand out. They're going to stand out more, perhaps.
That's a good point.
But are they going to receive the love of the masses? I don't think so. But then again, maybe surround yourself with people who don't need the masses. And, you know, the quality may speak for itself, and I hope that it does. I'm constrained to set parameters in my daily show. I have 1 hour to interview 4 or 5 people, and you only get about 10 minutes per person. And there are some amazing people who have amazing things to say, and you're having to cut them because you've got to go to break. And the TV medium, I think, is also, even the TV medium is going out of favor. It's demo day, if you will. Because now it's TikTok, it's 15-second videos, it's 30-second videos. What does that do to our mind? I mean, I think that we'll be a generation of children who will grow up on manufactured images, on the expectation of super efficiency when it comes to information. I think that will lead to a much colder humanity. I think the warmth will go away. I think it will feel like, I think, a futuristic movie where all the tones and hues are blues and purples and cool tones, and everyone's wearing white and gray. I feel like that is the aesthetic that we are moving to inevitably. And the only counter to it is to be so radically opposed to it and so radically different from it that you do stand out and you do have a following of sorts who appreciates the work you do. Hopefully there will be a space for people who do wish to slow down, who do wish to, you know, cultivate
wish to think in a way that sort of requires a little bit of time and a little bit of knowledge. And we can't become a media dependent society without wanting and valuing the knowledge that you get from the media. I'm sort of concerned about that, but you know, everything is in a rapid state of flux, and you know, we need good people and critical thinkers like you, and I hope you stay in media somehow, even though it sounds like you're going to be fighting the fight on the law. But maybe you could do multiple things at once. I'm sure you can. So
I seem to be doing multiple things at once at this point. Yes. So why stop now?
That's right. Well, it was great to have you take the time to join us in this discussion. And I'm going to check back with you soon and see if things have advanced for the better or for the worse. But thanks a lot for doing this.
It's such an honor. Thank you, Dr. Atlas.
Okay. See you next time. Thanks for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Chanel Rian, watch her hard-hitting commentary on One America News, OAN, and her show Fine Point with Chanel Rian. Follow her on Rumble and on her Twitter account, @ChanelRian. And don't forget, subscribe to this show on YouTube, as well as Spotify, Apple, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now. And I'll see you next time.